So yeah, welcome. My name's Sangadharan, if you weren't here at the beginning. And yeah, so we're starting a 3-week series today. So this is the first class in a 3-week series looking at Dado Rinpoche and his kind of motto that he taught. It's kind of a motto that's kind of goes with him, as it were. So we're going to be looking at the life of Dado Rinpoche, and we're going to be looking at one of his teachings. And I just want to start. This isn't a test. I just want to see who. Can you put your hand up if you've heard of Dado Rinpoche? Just so I can get a sense of. Okay, great. Yeah, so maybe like a third of people. So I'm going to say a little bit about Dado Rinpoche and why he's relevant to us, why we're talking about him, and then we're going to talk about his motto. And especially today, we're going to focus on one line of it, and then throughout the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking at the other sections of it. So the motto we're going to be look at is cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. So it's cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. And if you've been to our retreat center, Vajrasana, you might have noticed that written on the stupa. So these things here behind me are stupas. And at our retreat center, we've got a really big one. It's a lot bigger than that one. And it's got that written on there. So it has cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love on there. To kind of, and as you walk around, you kind of see that repeated again and again. And the reason why he's significant to us is he's one of the main teachers of the person that founded this tradition. So the person that founded this tradition is a man called Sangharakshita, and he lived in India for a number of years. And while he was there, he had various teachers. From mainly from the Tibetan tradition, but not just the Tibetan tradition. And one of them was Dado Rinpoche. And so he's one of the main teachers in our kind of lineage, as you were. And his ashes are in that stupa. So that's why his motto is there, because his ashes are in that stupa. And actually, lots of the retreat centers in our tradition have his ashes in. And it's one of the things, that's what a Buddhist tradition is. You get some relics as when someone's cremated, their relics are kind of spread out to different disciples, and then their ashes are put into stupas, as these are as well. So these all have people's different order members' ashes in. So yeah, he's a very significant figure in our movement, and you may not have heard of him. Yeah, so I've seen lots of you haven't heard of him, but he's very significant for our movement. And if you're coming to the London Buddhist Center, or any kind of center within our movement, you will be influenced by Dado Rinpoche, whether you realize it or not. So he's a significant person for us if we're practicing in this tradition. And I'm just going to start by telling you a bit about his life. He had a very had an amazing life, really. And so I'm just going to start by saying a little bit about his life. And I think over the next couple of weeks, people will say a bit more about him. But I'll just kind of give you some facts about his life before we start. So he was born in East Tibet. So he's Tibetan. He was actually born in Tibet in 1918, in Eastern Tibet, in a town called Darsendo. And his name Dado is actually an abbreviation of Darsendo. So that's kind of where the name comes from. And he came from a wealthy family. So his mother was kind of an aristocratic, of an aristocratic family, and his dad was a wealthy trader. So he came from a wealthy family, and then when he was born, he was quite quickly recognized as a tolku. And a tolku is basically someone who's recognized as a reincarnation of a great lama in the Tibetan tradition. So this is a big part of Tibetan Buddhism. We don't do the tolku system here. So it's not something that we've carried on. But in Tibet, that was a big part of their practice. So a great esteemed lama would die, and after their death, they'd look for signs. So it might be dreams, or it might be something that's left in the ashes that would kind of show them where to go to find the reincarnation. And he was quickly seen to be a reincarnation of a great lama. And Dado himself, he didn't place much value on the whole reincarnation thing. He was kind of like, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, I don't know. He wasn't the sort of person who kind of really bought into it. But what he did say was the fact that he was recognized as a tolku meant that other people looked to him as if he was a tolku, and that made him act as if he was one, which then made him act in a way with a lot of compassion and a lot of wisdom, which then allowed him to generate those qualities. So it's quite interesting. He's basically saying because he had to act like one, he became one. And I think we could all learn something from that. So if we could all just act like we were tulkus, or if we want to kind of, if that's how we want to be, if we want to be wise and compassionate, we just start acting as if that's what we need to be in the world, then naturally that will help us act in those ways. So I really like that part of the story where it's like he didn't take it all that seriously, but he did take the responsibility that he was given very seriously. And he really acted in that way. And you can see in his life, he acted with great compassion throughout his whole life. So from a young age, he was really devoted to his spiritual learning, his spiritual discipline. It said that he was at the age of 4, so he's 4 years old, he was expected to get up at 4 a.m. And memorize verses from Buddhist scripture. And then he had to do that for a few hours. And he did have a, there was a few hours later in the day where he was allowed to play. But there was a, from a very early age, he was expected to be really committing himself to spiritual life, to kind of study and practice. And then for 17 years, he took a course in Geshe studies. So this is like a 70, it's basically his whole schooling was basically from a really young age for 17 years. His whole schooling was basically training him how to be a really deep Buddhist practitioner, which I think is so good. It's just like all of his formative years was basically set up to let him really study the Dharma, really understand the teachings of the Buddha, be able to talk about it, be able to understand it, and practice it and help others. So we had 17 years of this really intense training. In these in this monastic setting, so that he could become this lama, become this tulku. So he had a very like firm training in the Dharma, firm foundation in practicing Buddhism. And then jumping forward for a significant period of his life, he was the abbot, so he was kind of in charge of a Tibetan monastery. In Bodh Gaya. So Bodh Gaya is the place in India where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and different traditions have monasteries there. So if you go to Bodh Gaya, there's all sorts of different monasteries from different traditions, and he was put in charge of the monastery from his tradition. And when he was put there, he wasn't actually particularly popular. Apparently, the people that lived there didn't really want to practice Buddhism. They didn't really want to take it very seriously. Whereas when he turned up, he was like, no, if we're going to have a monastery, we're going to be practicing. We're going to be practicing Buddhism. We're going to be following the teachings of the Buddha. So he wasn't always that popular when he was there, but he was extremely principled in wanting people to practice if he was going to be in charge of this monastery. And then as time went on, it became more and more clear that China were going to invade Tibet. So it didn't happen straight away, but the signs were there for quite a long time, it seems, and more people kind of could see that was the way it was going. And Dado could see this as well. And he saw that if Tibetan culture was going to be preserved, it was going to need to be preserved outside of Tibet. It wasn't going to stay, be maintained in Tibet if the Chinese came over. So he knew that he needed to do something to help Tibetan culture flourish in exile, basically. So he was in India and he wanted to do something to help Tibetan culture flourish. So what he did was he set up a school and eventually an orphanage to teach and house Tibetan refugee children. So there was a lot of children who had to flee from Tibet, either with or without their parents. So some came over with their parents, but some their parents had died or had to stay. So there were a lot of children kind of on the streets begging, in really bad conditions. And Dado saw this and he saw that they needed to do something about it. So he set up this school, and orphanage so he could kind of take these children in and teach them Tibetan culture, basically. He saw that they weren't going to learn Tibetan culture where they were, but he wanted to preserve it. He wanted to hand it on. So he took them in and then taught them Tibetan culture. It was actually interesting. There was a Tibetan film festival at Genesis Cinema last year, or maybe a couple of years ago. And apparently there were adults there who had gone to Dado Rinpoche's school as well. and said, well, just like very, spoke very highly of it, basically, being able to continue that. Well, it just meant they were taught their culture, basically. If he hadn't done that, they wouldn't have learned their culture. They'd have just been street kids in India, and well, they'd have just lost all of that. So yeah, he gave them this education, and he allowed, he did his part to make sure that Tibetan culture wasn't lost. And yeah, so just looking at his kind of day-to-day schedule now, it's pretty impressive. So he would get up at 4 in the morning, and then he'd do 6 hours of spiritual practice. So he'd meditate and do ritual for 6 hours to start off his day. So he'd kind of do multiple visualization practices. Apparently, he'd do a visualization practice while he was brushing his teeth. There's a specific one he did while he was brushing his teeth, and then kind of all of these rituals. So he did that for 6 hours. And then at the end of that, he'd then spend the rest of his day working on this school, working in this school with these children, just pouring all of his energy into that. So he kind of started his day with a heavy dose of personal practice, as you were, kind of working on his mind. And then the rest of it, he just spent pouring out to help these children. And then apparently he'd usually go until about 11 in the evening, but sometimes he'd end up working until about 1 in the morning. But regardless of when he went to bed, he still got up at 4, and then carried on with his day again. So doing the 6 hours of practice again. So the very, very remarkable practice. I read his autobiography. I think I was on the solitary, and no, not auto. I read his biography while I was on solitary retreat, and I was like, oh my. It's very impressive what he's doing. I was like, I am not doing that right now. Wasn't doing awfully, but I wasn't doing that. So yeah, this was while he was in Kalimpong, which is in kind of northern India. So Kalimpong was quite significant because it was one of the trading towns nearest Tibet. So a lot of the Tibetans that fled ended up going through Kalimpong, and a lot of the eminent Tibetan teachers ended up passing through Kalimpong when they were fleeing. And Sangrachta, who founded our movement, he hadn't founded the movement at this time. He'd kind of moved over to India, expecting to stay there forever. And he was told by his teacher to stay in Kalimpong for the good of Buddhism. So he just thought, I'm just going to stay here, and I'm going to work for the good of Buddhism. And it just happened that when he was there, all of these amazing teachers were passing through. He's just really lucky to be there at the time when all of these teachers came through. So we ended up getting teachings from lots of different kind of very important teachers within that tradition. No, yeah, within the Tibetan tradition. So if you look at the great teachers of the time, Sangrachta actually had contact with a lot of them, who are kind of like really revered throughout the whole of Tibetan Buddhism. But yeah, while he was there, Dado Rinpoche was in Kalimpong as well, and they developed a friendship together, basically. Sangrachta and Dado Rinpoche formed a friendship. And Dado said that up until that point, his relationships with his students had been very formal. There was in Tibetan Buddhism, there's very much kind of the guru is sat up very high, kind of gives initiations from a distance, and maybe there'll be some interviews one to one, but the contact and the interaction is very formal. And he said this is the first time that he developed a friendship between a disciple. And it was much more of a friendship that was formed between them. And they both learnt from each other as well. They both inspired each other, and they both learnt from each other. And yeah, this friendship is very significant for us. So you may have heard within our tradition, there's a strong emphasis on spiritual friendship as a practice. So the idea that we want to be forming deep friendships with other people who are also wanting to work on their mind is a really big emphasis in our tradition. And this connection between Dado and Sangrachta is one of the probably one of the founding. This is where that idea first started for Sangrachta, really, because he had this teacher who he really looked up to, he really admired, he was learning a lot from, but also they had a friendship that meant they could connect in that way as well. And we've kind of our traditions now kind of imbibed that relationship, and that's how kind of we view spiritual friendship in this tradition. And yeah, Dado was deeply impressed by Sangharakshita's ability to learn the Dharma, but not just learn it, but then also teach it straight away. And yeah, so he's really encouraging of Sangharakshita returning to the West and spreading Buddhism, which is what Sangharakshita ended up doing. He came back from India and spread Buddhism in the West. And yeah, as the movement developed, many order members, so people that were ordained into our movement, ended up going back to visit Dada Rinpoche as well. He was alive for about 20 years while the movement was still going. So lots of order members went back and had personal contact with him. And he said that he saw no distinction between Sangharakshita's disciples and his disciples. So he felt a strong connection to this movement as well. So it's not just that kind of we look up to him, but he felt a strong connection to the movement that we're a part of. And yeah, his school, also there's a charity set up within our movement to help projects in India as well. And his school was helped by that charity as well, Karuna. And then in 1990, Dada Rinpoche passed away. So about 30, 35 years ago, and now he passed away. And yeah, there's lots more you could hear about Dada Rinpoche, but that's kind of a brief overview of his life. And if you wanted to hear more, I recommend, we had a day the other day celebrating his life, and Suvajra, who wrote a book, he wrote the biography on Dada Rinpoche. He did a talk, on Dada Rinpoche's life. So if you go onto our podcast, you can hear that talk. It's a really good talk about like a more full account of Dada Rinpoche's life. So yeah, that's a little bit about Dada Rinpoche. And then his motto was cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. And that was kind of his view on the Dharma. But also it was the motto of his school as well. So that was what he was trying to imbibe in the children he was teaching. Okay, so what we'll do now, we'll meditate now, and then in the second half we'll kind of go into cherish the doctrine. So if you want to set up for meditation. Okay, great. So yeah, we're gonna move into looking at the first part of Dada Rinpoche's motto now, which is cherish the doctrine. And I'm gonna start with how any great Dharma talk starts is with a dictionary definition. So I'm gonna start with it was an online dictionary. I don't think I have a dictionary anymore, but this, yeah, so. Yeah, so it's cherish the doctrine. So we're going to look at cherish. So the definitions I got were to hold something dear and to keep a hope or ambition in one's mind. So to hold one's dear or to keep a hope or ambition in one's mind. And then I made one up myself, which I liked, which is to place our heart on something. So that's what I kind of think of when I think of cherish, is place our heart on something. But that's my one, so if you quote it, quote me. And then, yeah, then it says, cherish the doctrine. And here, doctrine's basically talking about the teachings of the Buddha. So it's the teachings that the Buddha taught and all the teachings that have developed since then. But I thought we'd start by just clarifying, actually, what is the Dharma? You might hear this word a lot if you come along. Yeah, we talk about it quite a lot, so we'll kind of, if we're referring to the teachings, we'll say the Dharma. But I want to just clarify, actually, what is it? So Buddhism has so many different teachings. It's been around for 2,500 years, and there's so many different ways that it teaches. So there are teachings about how to act in the world. There's kind of ethics. There's meditation, so how to work with your mind. There's kind of concepts to help us make sense of our experience as well. There's like lists of mental states that we can try and make sense of our experience with. There's teachings that use the rational mind to overcome the rational mind, such as koans, or there's texts called the Perfection of Wisdom texts that kind of use language to undermine the way that we normally see things. And then there's also kind of myths, images and symbols that can speak to the deeper parts of ourselves, the non-rational parts of ourselves, the kind of unconscious parts of ourselves, you might say. There's all of these different teachings. And then also it looks very different. If you look through the history of Buddhist tradition, it looks really different. So you've got Pure Land schools that are just all about devotion, and then you've got Zen, which is all about meditation, and then you've got Theravadan Buddhism, which is all about the things that the Buddha actually said, the kind of early teachings of Buddhism. And then you have later kind of tantric Buddhism, where there's all of these visualizations and deities and rituals. And if you first encounter all of these, they all look so different. It's like, how do we tell what is the Dharma? How can we tell what is actually the teaching of the Buddha? And the Buddha gave a teaching on this when he was alive. He kind of taught us how to tell whether something is the Dharma or is not the Dharma. So his aunt, who actually he was, so she's called Mahapad. I always practice this, and I always get it at home, and then when I'm in front of everyone, I can't say it. So it's Maha Pajapati. That's her name, and she was the Buddha's mother's sister, but his mother died in childbirth, so he was raised by his aunt, basically, and she was the first woman to request ordination after the Buddha had started teaching. Had started ordaining people. She was the first person to request, the first woman to request ordination. And she was a serious practitioner in herself, in herself. And she comes to the Buddha with a concern. She says, lots of people come around giving teachings. They kind of say they say they know the truth, but how can we tell what teachings are in line with the Dharma? How can we tell which teachings are in line with what you teach? And the Buddha replied that she could work out for herself. We could all work out for ourselves what is the true Dharma. And he said, you can work it out by seeing if they're in accord with a certain list of things. So I'll read out what he said. So he said, whatever teachings you can be sure conduce to tranquility and not to greed and hatred, to freedom and not to enslavement, to decrease in worldly ties and not to increase of them, to contentment and not to covetousness, to solitude and not to social distractions, to energy and not to sluggishness, to delight in good and not to delight in evil. Of these teachings, you can be sure that they constitute my Dharma. Yeah, so he's given us this list of things to check the teachings by. When we put them into practice, do they conduce to these things and do they lead away from these things? So we've got tranquility, freedom, renunciation, contentment, solitude, energy, and delight in goodness. So basically, he's saying whatever teachings lead us in the direction of enlightenment. So when I put something into practice, does it lead me in a positive direction? Does it lead me to meet more freedom, more contentment? Or does it lead me away from that into more craving, more hatred, more covetousness? So when I say that list, do people recognize if they've been meditating or practicing for any time at all, do people recognize that they've moved in this direction at least a little bit? Do people, could anyone say anything about that? What kind of stands out? Yeah, Martin, yeah.
They were working less, being more detached from identity that comes from my
Right. So do you think that's kind of that in the area of worldly ties? So, like having less worldly ties, not more worldly ties, yeah. And has that led to any of the other qualities that it's.
Yeah, these kind of related, right? So more tranquility, more kind of openness, love towards the world.
Yeah, great, thank you. Anyone else?
The solitude is an interesting one,
Mm.
And quite applicable, I think, when you're in a big environment such as London.
Mm.
So you can get quite distracted by those various different social circles, and have a desire to fulfill certain criteria. So I suppose solitude is an important factor to cultivate.
Yeah, and I think it's not it's not talking about solitude in terms of being a loner, kind of like being lonely. It's not encouraging that so much. It's encouraging more of a sense of being self-sufficient. I think that's kind of the way to put it. It's kind of like I can tend to myself. I can kind of get my needs met. Not all, but that's not even the right way to say it. It's kind of just a sense of I'll be okay, regardless of what goes on with other people. It's not that we can't interact with other people. It's just that we're not trying to get other people to make us okay in a certain way. It's like a deeper sense of, yeah, I'm okay as I am, and then I can interact in the world fully rather than having to try and get other people to kind of make us whole. I think that's more what it's getting at with solitude than just being by ourselves. But definitely time by ourselves is helpful for practice. And also the willingness to spend time by ourselves and be okay with that implies some level of that self-sufficiency. Yeah. Yeah, so there are certain things to practice the Dharma. There are certain things we all need to do. And there's kind of like some foundational things that if everyone did, especially kind of early on when we're getting involved or when we're starting to practice Buddhism, there's some like core things that we'll all need to do. So we'll all need to start looking at our ethics. We need to start looking at how we're acting in our lives, what effect that's having on other people and what effect that's having on ourselves. When I act in this way, does it lead to positive states of mind or does it lead to negative states of mind? And then does it lead to kind of a better better atmosphere or better other people around me feeling better or other people around me feeling worse? So we all need to start looking at what we're doing day to day in our lives outside of meditation, which leads me on to meditation. So we all need to be practicing meditation as well. We need to be developing awareness and we need to be developing positive emotions. That's what we're doing in the first half. We're doing the Metta Bhavana, which is very much about cultivating positive emotion, cultivating kind of like compassion and loving kindness and openness to other beings. But we're also cultivating awareness. Whenever we're turning towards kind of our experience, our inner world, we're also developing awareness. So they're kind of two fundamental things that we need to be developing if we're wanting to practice, if we're wanting to work on our minds. And then also just learning foundational Dharmic teachings. So there's a few teachings that the Buddha taught that are just really core that make sense of everything else. So kind of understanding craving leads to suffering, hatred leads to suffering. There are ways that I can act that lead to less suffering, such as following the Noble Eightfold Path, which is kind of seeing more clearly, getting my emotions on board with that, acting better, looking at how I am at work, looking at how I'm talking to other people, all those sorts of things. There's lots of foundational teachings that the Buddha taught that they're not really hard to grasp. They're very applicable and they're very helpful in our lives. So we all, if we want to be practicing Buddhism, we want to have some basic understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And another thing to be doing is developing connections with other people that are practicing as well. It's a really strong emphasis in Buddhism is that we want to be practicing alongside other people. We want to have other people who are also practicing, trying to move in the direction that we're moving in to kind of support us, uplift us, encourage us, and course correct us if we need it. Yes, we want people who are more experienced than us to kind of help us and see. They can see more because they've done it longer than we have. But we also want people who are doing it alongside us, people who are at a similar stage. And you can really feel like, oh, I'm doing this with people. I've got friends that I'm doing this with. And then as we start to practice more, we'll have more to offer other people as well. So when people are newer to the practice, we'll be able to start helping people. So it's really important that we're engaging in all of these sorts of ways if we're wanting to really practice the spiritual life. Yeah, and then finally, we'll want to be engaging in some sort of devotional practices, some sort of practice that's putting us in touch with something higher than we are now, some consciousness that we want to move towards and feeling an emotional connection with that. So these kind of all lay the groundwork for our spiritual life. So when thinking about the doctrine, it's kind of taught, this is kind of the groundwork of that teaching. That's the groundwork of the Dharma. So I'm saying these are things that we all need to be doing, but also we all have different temperaments. And this is something we need to take into account as well if we're trying to practice. We all have different temperaments that will lead us to being more drawn to one thing or another. Yeah, so if we're particularly rational, there are people who are just naturally have a very good rational mind. They kind of like reason, they like thinking things through, and they might be more drawn to conceptual teachings. They might be really sparked off by learning all of the different lists and kind of understanding how they all fit together, which is perfectly fine. That's a perfectly good way to approach it. And then we might also have more emotional types of people that feel just there's much more of an emotional response to things, and they might be more drawn towards devotional practices or figures and imagery and that kind of thing. And these are just temperaments. We'll probably all be drawn more towards one thing or another. And yeah, people might have a strong imaginal faculty and they'll like engaging with the imagery, and some people might find that harder, but they really like the stories. There's all of these different ways that we'll be encountering the Dharma, and some of them will resonate with us more than others. But the good thing is that the Dharma is expressed in so many different ways. So we've had this 2,500-year tradition that's developed and evolved into all of these different forms, and there's all of these different ways to express the Dharma. You could think about these different doors to the Dharma. There's different Dharma doors, there's different ways in, and there's loads of different ways in. But the good thing about the Dharma is it's a completely integrated system. So it's as if you go deeply enough into any one part, the rest of it will flower, the rest of it, you'll find it there. So one of the images for that is it's like a big net that's joined together with lots of jewels. And in all of these points where it's joined together, if you look into any one of the jewels, all of the rest of the jewels are reflected within it. So you've got this completely integrated web of teachings and practices. And if you go deeply enough into any of them, all of the rest of it will emerge within it. So what we can do is we can go towards the things we're lit up by. We can find the things that we resonate with. Because in a way, we don't need loads of Dharma to practice. We don't need loads of teachings to transform. Sangharakshita said that one verse of the Dharmapada, which is it's one of the earliest teachings, and it's kind of in these two, these couplets, so there's like two lines together. And he says one verse of the Dharmapada could take you all the way to enlightenment. So just one verse, if we really went into it deeply enough, could take us all the way to enlightenment. So we really don't need a lot of Dharma. But what we do need to be doing is we need to be engaging with something. We need to be engaging with some aspect of the Dharma. And there's an order member called Sadanandi, and she said this thing that I really liked, that when she listens to the Dharma or when she reads the Dharma, she's not trying to learn it all. What she's looking for is words of power. Yeah, so she's reading and she's looking for words of power. And she said what words of power are is words that can change your life, which I really like. So when she's listening to the Dharma, when she's reading the Dharma, what she's looking out for is words that can change your life. And so these are teachings that when you hear them, your heart goes, yes, yes, that's right. There's some deep resonance with it that says that is the truth. And for some reason, it might be obvious or it might not be obvious. This is really relevant to me right now. This is really important for me to change in the direction that I want to change in. So yeah, we're looking for these words of power. I'm just going to share one. It's not really related to the rest of the talk, but it's a word of power that really stayed with me. So I just wanted to share that. So I was reading some of Sangharakshita, and he just said this line, and I was on a solitary retreat, and I was experiencing quite a lot of fear, which happens if you're on solitary retreat, disclaimer, but it's good. And then he said, where there is fear, there is ego, and where there is ego, there is fear. And for me, that just really hit something, where it changed it from fear being something that was something going wrong, something I should be scared of, something I should be trying to avoid, towards it being a practice, to the experiencing fear could turn into a practice where I could see that I'm constructing something, that I'm trying to hold something together, that I'm trying to create a self. And I'm not going to go into that teaching very much more, but just for me, that really stands out as a time in my life when I experienced a word of power or some words of power, and they've really stayed with me since then. Yeah, so what we're going to do now, why don't we get into threes, and we can just say, have we ever had any teachings like that? It doesn't have to be within Buddhism. If you've been around for a while, then it's probably good to try and look for it within Buddhism. But if you're quite new, just something you've heard that's really stayed with you, and it isn't just, oh, I like that, that sounds good, but it's actually changed you, it's actually had an effect on you, where it's actually allowed you to change your life. So just, are there any kind of words of power that you've experienced in your life? So if you want to find two other people, get into threes, and we'll just spend a few minutes exploring that with other people. Okay. Does anyone want to share any words of power? Like a greatest hits compilation. Yeah.
One of the ones that struck me when I first came along was you're not your thoughts. You're not what you think. That was really like this. I don't know, like, oh, there's like a lot more to me than just whatever happens in my mind. I'd get any given moment. And then I remember hearing soon after, you are what you dwell on as well. And it's like, oh, it's sort of both sides, like, you are what you think, and also you're not what you think, or something. That was kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely words of power. That's good. Yeah, great. I'm not going to explore them in too much depth because they'll derail my talk if we go down too many, but it's good to hear them. These are like good examples of words of power, isn't it?
So this is a quote from Gaurav Ghosha. One big implication of an interdependent universe is that every action affects the whole. Really strong. Every single thought, action, and word affects everything. It remnants outwards.
Great.
Just adding meaning to everything that's happening.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah.
The first line of the Dhammapada, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. So the fact that I'm experiencing the world and I have power and agency to change my experience. I'm not stuck.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thank you, you three. So can you see how these are just short sentences or a couple of sentences? If you really kept them with you and turned them over, and they'd have a transformative effect on your life. So that's what we want to be looking for when we're encountering the Dharma. We want to be understanding it, but we also want to be finding these kind of gems that we can keep with us and cherish them. Yeah, so it's cherish the doctrine. We're looking for things that we can cherish, that we can take into our hearts and hold them with us, so that they can transform us. And it's important that we do this with what resonates with us. It needs to be honest, it needs to be authentic, it needs to be things that actually resonate with us, teachings that actually kind of have an emotional effect on us. And I think it's nice hearing you three talking, because you can see in the way that you talk about it that it's had an effect, and you can see that you're kind of moved by them. So this is what we're looking for when we're engaging with the Dharma. So I'm saying that we want to be finding teachings that we resonate with. And I want to caveat this with, this doesn't mean we kind of disregard anything that we don't resonate with, especially if we're reacting to it. Because the Dharma challenges us. It challenges us on the most fundamental level of our wrong views, kind of like all the way down to our most fundamental wrong views, we're going to be challenged. So if any time we hear a teaching or we do a practice that we react to, you can't just be like, oh, I don't resonate with that. when people first encounter the Metta Bhavana, you quite often get people that really don't like it. And it's normally because they just need to be more in touch with their emotional life. The Metta Bhavana is a practice that requires you to look at your emotions. It requires you to look at your the way that you're interacting with other people. And that can be really difficult. And if we're not very in touch with our emotions, we really don't want to do that. So we can react to it. It's important that we're aware of what we're resonating with. But that looking for what we're resonating with doesn't mean that we disregard things that we react to. Yeah, we've got that. So we want to have our emotions engaged, though. We want to have our emotions engaged in the spiritual life. And this is in all aspects of the Dharma. So we want to be emotionally invested in our ethics, in our actions. We want to be emotionally invested in our meditation, in our friendship. But what we're looking at today, what we're focusing on today, is the teachings, the doctrine. So we're looking to cherish the doctrine. So this is specifically cherishing the teachings of the Buddha. And so we can reflect on, do we cherish the Dharma? Do we really cherish the teachings of the Buddha? And if we're honest, a lot of us won't cherish the Dharma. A lot of us will cherish different things. And the things that we cherish really are sense experience. Yeah, so we cherish pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant smells, pleasant tastes, pleasant feelings. Pleasure, basically. Pleasure of the senses is what we really cherish most of the time. We're kind of in the sense world and we want pleasurable sense experiences. That's what we're cherishing pretty much all of the time. But the problem with these pleasurable experiences is they don't last, and when they stop, or if they don't come when we want them to, then we suffer. So it's not reliable. It's not reliable to cherish the sense our sense experiences. And there's words for this. There's karmachanda, which is the desire for sense experience, and there's dharmachanda, which is the desire for realizing the truth of the Dharma. So kind of chanda means desire or volition towards. So there's karmachanda, which is desire for sense experience, and dharmachanda, which is desire for realizing the Dharma. And by cherishing the doctrine, we're basically trying to move towards dharmachanda. We're trying to develop that desire for the Dharma, that desire for that freedom, that liberation that the Dharma can give us, and away from the limited pleasures that sense experience can give us. So we want to be moving more and more towards dharmachanda. So that I brought that in for the... It's another way of thinking about this cherishing. It's this desire to move towards. Yeah, so Buddhism talks about levels of wisdom as well. So what we need to do is to let the Dharma sink in on deeper and deeper levels of our being. So we'll encounter the Dharma and we need to let it sink to deeper and deeper levels of our being. And it talks about these three levels of wisdom. So what I'm going to do now, I'm just going to go through these three levels and we kind of see how they apply to our lives. So the first level is wisdom through hearing. So this is Shruta Mai Pranya, which is, yes, is the wisdom through hearing. It's basically when we hear the Dharma. So we've all done that. Because you're all doing it right now. So you're in a talk, you're listening to the Dharma. If you've read a book about the Dharma, if you've listened to a podcast or watched a YouTube video, anything where you've come across the teachings of the Buddha, this is the wisdom through hearing. It's the first level of wisdom. So whether it's reading, listening, studying together, we're hearing the teachings of the Buddha. And what's important with this is repetition. It's important that we're hearing the Dharma again and again and again. It's not enough to just hear it once with this. With Shrutimai Pranya, it's this repetition to the point where traditionally it would be knowing it by heart. It would be having the Dharma at our fingertips, really knowing it, being able to bring it to mind at the appropriate time and kind of, yeah, really having it in our bones. And actually, this is one of the reasons why I love being on the team at Dharma Night, is because every week I just hear the Dharma again and again and again. And often I'm hearing something I've heard before, but put in a slightly different way. And what that does is it allows me to be exposed to the Dharma again and again and again. And the reason why it's important to hear the Dharma and to repeat hearing the Dharma, and when I say hearing, it's including reading, etc., is each time there's a potential for a new understanding. There's a potential for it to sink down on a deeper level. Because in a way, from a Dharmic perspective, we never hear the same teaching twice. Because if we're constantly changing, we're just a constantly changing process. We're never the same. So every time we hear a teaching, we're different. So in a way, we never hear the same teaching twice. So each time we'll be a different person when we hear it. So potentially it will land very differently. If we've deepened our understanding of other aspects of the Dharma, maybe that one then slots into place. or if we've gained a deeper understanding of our mind, a deeper experience of our mind, maybe we'll understand the teaching more experientially. So it's really important that we're hearing the same teachings again and again, and then they might be, well, through time, it will reach deeper and deeper depths of understanding of this Shrutamaya Pranya. And once people have been coming along for the Buddhist Center for a couple of years, I'm sure lots of you experienced this. You'll have heard the life of the Buddha multiple times. I had this when I first came along. It's kind of the first couple of years. It's like, oh, I'm hearing the life story of the Buddha again. And understandably, people are a bit like, oh, boring. And like, again. But actually, in a way, it's missing the point. It's understandable, but it's missing the point. The implications of the life of the Buddha are so deep. We do need to be hearing it again and again and again. We need to be understanding the incidents of the Buddha's life story again and again and again, understanding the deeper implications of what it's really getting at. Because as we go deeper into our spiritual life, as we understand ourselves and our mind more, we'll see deeper implications in the life of the Buddha. And that's why we keep on telling it. That's why we need to keep on turning over the life of the Buddha in our minds so that we can understand what it's getting at on deeper and deeper levels. So part of the practice is that is, can I hear the same teaching and stay receptive? I think when we've heard the Dharma, lots of, we've kind of got a basic ground of Dharma teachings, the practice then becomes, how do I hear the same thing and stay receptive? How do I not just switch off and think, oh, I've heard this teaching before? Well, I've heard the three levels of wisdom before. When can I go home? It's how can I stay receptive to the teachings, even though conceptually I know it, but understand there's deeper for it to go in. So staying receptive to the teachings. Okay, so that's wisdom through hearing. And then the next stage is reflecting. So it's wisdom through reflecting. And this is Chintamaya Pranya. So this is, once we've heard a teaching, once we kind of know a teaching and understand a teaching, we then need to reflect on it. So in Buddhism, you don't learn the Dharma to become clever. You don't learn the Dharma to become more intellectual, to be able to discourse and prove how good you are at the Dharma. And that's not why we're doing it. We're learning it so that we can start reflecting on it and so that we can start applying the teachings to our lives, basically. The Dharma isn't meant to be just stay on the level of concepts. It teaches in concepts so that we can look at our life through that lens, so we can start applying the teachings to our life and understand what's going on in our life, in our mind, more and more deeply. I keep saying the word deeply, but the whole point of the three wisdoms is we're going deeper, so you're probably going to have to bear with me as I keep on saying deeply. And so, yeah, we reflect on the teachings, we apply them to our lives, but also we want to be interrogating them for ourselves. We don't want to just be thinking, oh yeah, that's what the Dharma says, got it. We need to be interrogating and think, actually, is that true? I've heard this teaching, is that true? So it's really important that we're asking questions of the Dharma. We're asking questions to try and find out for ourselves, is what the Buddha taught true? Is what Buddhism says true? So we need to be asking questions. And this might be questions that have arisen from encountering a teaching. There might be a teaching that you don't understand or a teaching that you don't agree with. Or it might be that your life just presents you a problem and you have to think, how do I work with this? What would the Dharma say about this? Is what the Dharma says about this true? So it could be, does craving actually cause me suffering? Okay, so Buddhism says that craving is the cause of suffering. Actually ask, does craving cause me suffering? Look into our experience and think, is that actually true? When I have craving, do I actually then suffer? Because we need to be finding out for ourselves. We need to be understanding for ourselves whether that teaching is actually true, so that we can believe it on a deeper level, so that we can believe that actually no, craving does cause me suffering, therefore I want to move away from it. And same, so are all things actually impermanent? Buddhism teaches that all things are impermanent, but actually, is it? You know, like I've been coming to the Buddhist Center for 7 years and that wall looks the same to me, is that actually impermanent? I don't experience it as impermanent, so I need to interrogate it and actually think about it, think it through. Are all things impermanent? And then it could be thinking, if I act generously, do I actually feel better? So Buddhism teaches that acts of generosity lead to a more expansive state of mind. And we need to actually try that and see if it's true. We need to act in a certain way and see what happens to find out if the Buddha was actually right when he said that. And with all those things, hopefully you will find that they are true. But unless you apply the teachings to your own life, unless you reflect on the teachings yourself, you won't know from your own experience whether what the Dharma said is true or not. So it's really important that we're learning the Dharma, but also reflecting on it. And yeah, this is just in relation to this. It's important that we take our doubts seriously as well. So when we're practicing, doubts will arise. Doubts will arise about ourselves. Doubts will arise about the teachings we've been given. The doubts will arise about our teachers, the tradition, all these sorts of things to kind of undermine the way that we're practicing. Doubts will arise. And it's really important that we take these seriously in a certain way and interrogate them and communicate with people about them. Because if we don't, they can just stay there as a kind of festering block towards us actually growing. Yes, there's a healthy type of doubt that's actually trying to get to the bottom of things, that's actually trying to find out the truth, that's actually trying to interrogate things so that we can understand for ourselves the truth of things. But there's also an unhealthy version of doubt, which is basically this sort of vagueness that's unwilling to come to any conclusion, because if we do, that would mean we'd have to change. So Buddhism, if we really want to practice Buddhism, it requires us to change. If we really want to transform our mind, it's going to require us to be different from how we are now. And there's this insidious sort of doubt that kind of keeps us vague, that keeps us not committing to things, because on some level we don't actually want to change. So it's important that we take our doubts seriously and actually interrogate them and not let ourselves just stay in this sort of vague state where we're not coming to any conclusions about things. Yeah, and the reason we're doing this is basically so we can make the teachings our own. So we want to make the teachings not just something we've learned, but something we've actually experienced through our life, so that we can then apply it and understand it and communicate about it in concrete terms. Yeah, and then finally, the last stage is traditionally it's translated as meditation. So we've heard the Dharma, we've reflected on the Dharma, and then the last stage is we meditate on the Dharma. Maybe a better translation comes from one of our rituals. And the translation is, this stage is the stage of realizing. So it's that we've heard it, we've reflected on it, and then we've realized it. And this is basically the stage where we see into the truth of things, where on the deepest level we've seen into the truth of things. And these are the moments that transform us. They're the moments where we kind of see fully what the Dharma is getting at in a non-conceptual way. It's as if we're seeing it with clear eyes. And it becomes not just something that we're convinced of, but it becomes something that we know, that we experience, that we embody. So we're then not just, we haven't just learnt the Dharma, it's that we're embodying the Dharma and we're living the Dharma. And from that place, that's just how we see the world. We're just seeing the world in Dharmic terms. And this is the stage of insight, basically. It's the stage of clear vision of actually seeing how things are. It's the development of wisdom. It's kind of the wisdom in its fullness, wisdom with a capital W. Yeah, so maybe I'll just finish. I'll just talk about an experience I've had with these three stages. Just with one teaching. So this is just around the teaching of impermanence. So when I encountered Buddhism, I learned the teachings of the Buddha in various ways. I kind of came to classes, I read books, I did a study group. and the teaching of impermanence was talked about a fair amount. And on some level, it's like, okay, yeah, that's right. Things are impermanent. And I kind of knew that. I knew that's what Buddhism said. And it had no effect on my life whatsoever. And it's kind of, okay, I can say that now. I can say that Buddhism says that. And because I think of myself a Buddhist, I think that. But if you looked on a deeper level, I didn't actually think that. And then gradually, as I've practiced, as I've brought that teaching to mind more and more, I've seen more and more places in my life where that is true. Yeah, so I've kind of tried to keep it in my mind as I'm going through my life. And I've seen more and more places where it's true. So one of the main places I do this is on retreats. So I'm on a retreat, and you can see there are these conditions that have come together. You're there for a while. At the beginning, it's like, oh my God, I've got 10 days here. This seems so far away. And then as you go through it, time passes. And then before you know it, it's ended. And that's a good opportunity to reflect. Oh, yeah, this is impermanent. It's an experience that has arisen and it's passed. And I've done that lots of times on different retreats and seen, okay, yeah, there are those things are impermanent. And also just larger stages of my life, kind of keeping them in mind over stages of my life, especially there was a time when I was in my last year, I used to be a primary school teacher, and in my last year of teaching at the school, I just really didn't want to be there. I was finding it really hard and I really just wanted to leave, but I wanted to stick out the end of the year. So I had this kind of 9 month year ahead of me, and I could see part of me was just really trying to get to the end of it. It was really just trying to push experience to the end of it. And one of the things that kept me going was bringing to mind, oh, this is impermanent. It's difficult now. I'm finding this hard right now, but it is impermanent. And at the time, it didn't feel it. But now I can see it definitely was, because it's over. It's done. I'm through it. It's definitely over. And so that was by keeping impermanence in mind throughout that, I did become a little bit more convinced that even the difficult parts of my life, even the difficult stages of my life, they are going to pass. They're not going to last forever. And I think when I've found setups that work in my life as well, I've tried to bring in the reflection, actually, this is good, but at some point it's going to change. Either the conditions will change, so they're not like this anymore, or I'll change and actually the conditions just won't work for me anymore because I'm different. And I'm trying to like keep on bringing that to mind, so that I don't fall into a delusion of happily ever after, basically. When we find ourselves in situations, it's not to undermine them or not appreciate them. In a way, if we understand that they're impermanent, we'll appreciate them more, because we'll know that it's an impermanent thing and we'll make the most of it. So there's all of these different ways we can kind of reflect on impermanence and bring it into our lives. And I guess the last stage of realizing, and this isn't, I'm not making a definitive statement here on anything. There's definitely large parts of me that still don't believe things are impermanent, that still believe things are going to stay the same. But I have had some experiences in meditation where it's as if I was in a way of experiencing the world that was completely different. And there was, so this was on the, when we get ordained, we go on a long retreat. So there's an 11-week retreat where we do a lot of meditation. And I was kind of like in the midst of this, on this meditation retreat. And in meditation, a memory basically came up of a time when I was at university, and there were all the people in my life at university. I don't know why that came up. It's just that image emerged in meditation, of all the people that I was friends with and were around at the time of university. And I basically saw that I, in my mind, on some level, I believed that if I wanted to, I could go back to that time of my life and just pick up where I left off. As if everyone there was just there, like keeping things exactly the same, just waiting for me to come back if I wanted to. And if you'd asked me if that was happening, I would have said no. But on some deeper level, I saw that that's how I was experiencing the world. I was experiencing it as if I could just go back in time. Nothing else would have changed. I'm moving. Basically, I'm moving through this stationary, static world, and I would be able to go back and pick up if I wanted to. But I saw that actually this isn't true. Just as I've changed, they've all changed. Everything's changed. And that kind of expanded out to realizing all things are changing all the time. Kind of every single aspect of the of reality of the universe is constantly in this state of change. And it's as if there's this big wave just constantly going forward and nothing is untouched by it, or everything's part of it. And in a way, I'm using images there because I can't describe the experience. It was an experience of just really feeling myself as part of this constantly changing, constantly moving flow of experience. And that was a strong experience of seeing, oh, actually, I'm experiencing impermanence now. I've kind of learned about it. I've reflected on it. But for that time, in that meditation and a bit afterwards, I was just experiencing myself as impermanence, with all other things as impermanence, just flowing forward. So yeah, it's kind of the level of we need to learn about it, and then we need to reflect on it. And then in time, in deeper states of meditation, if we bring those teachings to mind, we'll realize it and we'll experience it. Yeah, so I'll just I'm just going to recap and then we'll finish. So the title of the talk was Cherishing the Doctrine. So what we're talking about there is we're trying to take the Dharma deeper into our hearts. We want to be cherishing the Dharma. We want to be holding it in our hearts. And the Dharma is basically whatever leads us to freedom, whatever teachings lead us in the direction of freedom. And we don't need loads of Dharma. Yeah, we don't need loads of Dharma. We need teachings that resonate with us and we can hold on to and turn over in our minds so they can actually change us. Yeah, we want teachings that are actually going to change us. And the way that we make the teachings go deeper is we hear them, we reflect on them, and then over time, by meditating on them, we realize them, we become them. And yeah, that's how real wisdom starts to blossom.